I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, we share our cities with creatures great and small. There are raccoons, rats, bats, coyotes, pigeons, deer, and in one city's baboons. Are these critters pests or neighbors who are ambassadors of the natural world who've adapted to our concrete jungle? They are, in fact, synanthropes, plants and animals that intimately share our urban spaces with us. These undomesticated wild animals can bring delight and chaos to our domestic world. Should we seek to resist their presence or take the opportunity to promote a more harmonious coexistence? This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We tend to think of our cities as places where nature has been pushed out, replaced by concrete, traffic, buildings, and millions of people, but actually, nature never really left. Coyotes patrol our neighborhoods, bats roost underneath our bridges, grackles take over parking lots, raccoons have learned to navigate trash cans, rooftops, and city streets. Even plants that we call weeds have found ingenious ways to thrive in the landscapes that we have created. And some of these creatures aren't simply surviving alongside us, they're changing, altering their behavior, and in many cases evolving in response to urban life. So perhaps the city isn't the opposite of nature. Maybe it is nature's newest ecosystem. Dan Werb explores that idea in his new book, Our Wild Familiars, How Animals Are Adapting to Cities and Reshaping the Natural World. And Dan Werb, welcome to The Source.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's talk about the word that you basically kind of built the book around, synanthropes. This word, where did you get it? I'm not familiar with this word, but it is really central to your book.
Yeah, I mean, it's as a writer, I come across words every once in a while, and some of them just stick in my mind, and this is one of them. So my last book was about the emergence of coronaviruses and sort of the science leading up to the COVID pandemic. And when I was looking into why there are so many more spillover events from viruses these days compared to the 20th century, I came across a research paper that had this word synanthrope in it talking about basically wild animals bringing pathogens into our cities. And, you know, this new book, as you say, it's not really about viruses. It's basically about animals and wild creatures in cities. But at the time, this word synanthrope really stuck with me. And so synanthrope is translated from the Greek to mean together with humans. And so it refers to this entire class of living organisms that have found niches, ways to survive and thrive in human modified environments. And it was a real, it really shifted my thinking entirely when you start thinking about the creatures around you as one type of animal or one type of plant, plants and animals that have specifically either been pulled into urban environments or pushed there, but in every case have found ways to kind of make the best of their situation.
Well, you know, humans are dominating the planet. We're reshaping the planet, changing the climate. It makes sense that if animals want to survive, they're going to have to adapt to the way that humans operate.
Exactly. And, one of the fascinating things about cities is that for a long time, biologists and ecologists referred to them as biological deserts. So there was this assumption that cities were places where, there's basically no biodiversity. There's humans, there's concrete, there's metal, there's plastic, and that's it. But over the past 20 years or so, there's been this emergent field of urban ecology. So ecologists who are looking at cities and towns and other urban spaces specifically as ecosystems in their own right. And what they've discovered is not only that cities are not biological deserts, but that in many cases, cities and towns are actually more biodiverse than the areas that surround them. So there are a greater number of species living in urban areas compared to surrounding areas. And that's related to a few different factors. I mean, one of the major ones is humans are animals like any other animal, and we want to settle where the resources are the most abundant. So if you think about where cities are located, they're often located on water, they're often located in fertile areas, and that's exactly where there's the greatest level of biodiversity. But of course, also there's urban sprawl that has kind of taken over areas and turned natural habitats into urban ones and sort of trapped the species that were there previously into what people talk about as the urban matrix or urban microhabitats or microfragments. And then now what we're also seeing is this flood actually of animal species into urban settings. And all of this has turned cities into these wonderfully biodiverse areas.
You mentioned all the things that cities have: concrete, plastic, steel, traffic, people, but also a lot of trash. That creates an opportunity for some of these scavenger animals to thrive, I would imagine.
So, I had an idea about what writing this book would be like. There's lots of field research. Every chapter is in a different city, profiling a different animal or in one case, a plant. And I think I had maybe a romantic idea about what that would look like in terms of, where I would be going to for the field research. And ultimately, I spent a lot of time hanging around garbage cans, a lot of time at city dumps, because as you say, like this is where animals are mostly going to be found, the wild animals. Biologists, ecologists have fancy words for garbage. They call it anthropogenic waste. What it really means is food waste in a lot of places. And so cities have transformed, nature in one particular way, that's the most, I would say, important for these urban creatures, in that they've created reliable, continual sources of food. And that's pretty rare in natural environments, especially when you think about larger predators or scavengers that are looking for, larger prey. They need to hunt, they need to move. There can be lean times, there can be times where, they don't eat for a long time. But in the city, garbage is deposited in places like clockwork. It is incredibly reliable. And that creates an incentive for a lot of different creatures to, if they find themselves in an urban area, to never leave, because it's, they have everything they need. They can find shelter within the various architecture that humans have created. There are always continual sources of water in urban areas, which is another issue that a lot of creatures face in natural spaces, is finding continual sources of water. And then they just have this reliable, constant, and ongoing access to food waste.
And then some people deliberately feed these animals. I mean, they see them as neighbors and they put out food for them. And so that's really the idea here. I mean, are we in conflict, or are we cohabitating? What are we doing with all of these animals all around us that have come to live in our cities? When we say welcome to the neighborhood, is it their neighborhood? I mean, they were here before us. Give us a call. What's your favorite, synanthrope that you come in contact with? Deer, raccoons? Do you have a friendly raccoon around your neighborhood? Give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues right after this.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to rewarding policyholders who keep their workers safe and losses low. More at texasmutual.com/TXM Advantage. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me on the line, Dan Werb. His new book is Our Wild Familiars, How Animals Are Adapting to Cities and Reshaping the Natural World. So you have synanthrope, that's your word. There's also this other word that I like a lot. It's called crepuscular. And that is the word that describes animals that really kind of operate at dawn and at dusk. We like to say, oh, they're nocturnal. Well, they're not really nocturnal. They're kind of in that twilight zone and in the dusk zone. So animals like skunks and possums, they like to come out just at those certain times, and you don't want to have a confrontation with an urban skunk. I don't think because it could be you'd come out the loser. These animals, is that an adaptation or is that just the way that they are?
Yeah, it depends. I mean, some creatures are naturally nocturnal or crepuscular. Skunks, for sure, are in that class of possums as well. But some animals actually shift the time in which they're active when they move into cities. And one of those is coyotes. So coyotes are not naturally nocturnal animals. I mean, they do hunt at night sometimes, but they're also very active during the day. Once they move into cities and towns, though, they often start shifting the periods in which they're most active to nighttime. That's a response to the number of humans that are around. So there are fewer humans around at night. They have greater freedom of movement. They're obviously harder to spot when it's dark outside. And so this is just one of the many behavioral adaptations that coyotes and other animals have undertaken. When they move into urban spaces.
Let's listen to a caller, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. If you've got a question or comment about animals that live with us in the cities. And let's go to Christina. And Christina, thanks. You're on The Source. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for bringing this up. Recently, a subdivision opened up down the road from us, and clearly, it displaced a large population of raccoons, deer, wild turkeys. But the raccoons are the ones that we especially felt bad for because one of them was pregnant and was eating from our bird feeders because she was nursing. And we just felt so horrible for them because they were just trying to survive. It just brought to mind our immigrant issue, you know, populations that are displaced, trying to survive.
Christina, thank you for your call. Appreciate you telling us about that. So urban areas, we're going to talk about raccoons in a bit, but let's talk about how urban areas are constantly changing. They're not static. And that means that these animals have to, you know, their homes get destroyed. They have to make a lot of changes, and they're able to do that well, Dan?
Yeah, I mean, in the case of raccoons, they're actually one of the most successful synanthropes, certainly in North America. The first chapter of this book covers raccoons in Toronto, Canada. And up there, there are somewhere between 150,000 and 640,000 raccoons that have found ways to adapt to the city of 3 million people. Raccoons are a really interesting species because they're in the order of the carnivora. So they are really closely related to weasels and wolves and cats and even whales. And they're only distantly related to primates like us, humans and other apes. But the way that they think, their cognitive processes in some ways really resemble the way that humans think. And there's one particular way that's very important for their adaptation to urban spaces, and that's in what's called cognitive flexibility. So raccoons, unlike coyotes, unlike weasels, have this capacity to unlearn, first of all, to learn new things quite rapidly, new ways to unlock puzzles in urban environments. But once they move into a different space, once they find that the strategy that they were using to unlock a puzzle, say open a garbage can or something else, isn't working, they can rapidly shift to trying something else. They can literally unlearn what they've learned and start fresh. This is something that's called a paradigm reversal. When you learn something and then, you decide, oh, this isn't working for me anymore, I'm going to try something new. And it's second nature to humans, right? Like, this is a fundamental part of the way that we think. In other species, though, especially distant ones from us, this isn't a very common trait. And yet, raccoons are this really unique species in that they have this high degree of flexibility, of cognitive plasticity that allows them to try many different approaches to problems, to discard approaches that aren't working, to try new things. And that's exactly what you need when you're moving through different urban areas. Some of the examples I give in the book are, you think about what an urban environment looks like for an animal like a raccoon. Well, it's not one big kind of homogeneous space. It's a bunch of different microhabitats, and each one of those requires a different set of strategies to master. So, a Walmart parking lot, for example, is going to be very different than navigating across a city street. That's going to be very different from navigating through a culvert under a highway. That's going to be very different than, mastering the attic of somebody's home or finding a space to live on the roof of an apartment building. But in every case, raccoons have demonstrated that they are up to the challenge, that they're able to look at each of these microfragment or microhabitats and take on, because of their extreme cognitive flexibility, to take on different strategies to master them. And they are light years ahead of other animals, particularly skunks and coyotes, in their ability to do that.
And they're also very good at modeled learning. They can see another raccoon solve a puzzle and they can pick that up.
Exactly. Yeah. And one of the things that often happens with urban animals is that if they've established themselves in a space, in an urban space, their population density is much higher than in natural areas. In the case of raccoons and a lot of other animals, their range reduces in size. Often with raccoons, it's about 3 times smaller than their home range in natural, wild spaces. And so they move in a smaller kind of circle. Their population density is much higher. And because they have this innate social learning, that gives them a lot more opportunities to learn new things. So if a single raccoon unlocks a puzzle, there's going to be other raccoons in that urban environment that are watching, that are learning, and that can then transmit that knowledge socially across their social networks.
It's kind of scary. Let's go to another caller. Sheridan, you're on the air. Thanks for calling into The Source. Go ahead.
Thank you. This is a really interesting discussion. We live on the northwest side of San Antonio in the hospital district. Our apartment complex backs up to parking lots and a hospital. But in the time we've lived here, we've had raccoons, which are kind of a pain, possums, skunk, deer, a pair of gray foxes, and unbelievably, a porcupine. And I have no idea how the porcupine got to this area because there's really no wildlife corridor. We put out water for the birds, and these mammals will come into the water. It is amazing what's here when you actually start looking.
And listening. Yeah. Sheridan, thank you for your call. Appreciate that. So do we have filters on, blinders on, Dan, that we just kind of don't pay attention, but once we start paying attention, boom, it's going to be all over the place.
I mean, this has been my experience, to be honest. When I was doing the research for this book, I there was a moment, you know, it was sort of slow over time, but I suddenly realized to myself that I was extremely aware of not only the other species that were surrounding me in cities and towns, but also the fact that I was participating in an ecosystem, whether I wanted to or not. I mean, this is the fact of the matter. You know, if you're living in a city or town or anywhere else, you are inextricably linked with the other species that are there. You might like them, you might hate them, you might feel nothing for them, but there is this relational, this complex web of relations that are, you know, that are constant, that are constantly transforming, but they are extremely active in urban spaces. And, you know, again, this is why there is this field of urban ecology that treats cities and towns as legitimate ecosystems in their own right. I'll give you one fascinating example in terms of the complexity that can arise when there are multiple species competing for space. So, you know, pigeons are pretty much everywhere in cities. They are looked down upon. They're cursed. Humans generally don't like them. You know, and we're constantly complaining about either to ourselves or to others about, you know, why are these birds, these dim-witted birds just hanging around? Why are they constantly underfoot? And they just seem like stupid animals that don't know better. But what pigeons are actually doing is they are using humans, and they haven't realized this, you know, a single pigeon isn't going to realize this, but as a species, pigeons have evolved behaviorally to be as close to humans as possible, because they have understood that being close to humans is protective against other predators. So if a pigeon is underfoot of a human, a red-tailed hawk isn't going to fly down and snatch it in its claws, or a coyote isn't going to run out of, you know, the bushes and try to eat it. So, you know, we think of ourselves as sort of alone in urban environments. We think of ourselves as mastering and directing everything. And, you know, we have an outsized influence on that. But that doesn't stop other creatures from using our presence in these creative ways to, you know, to survive and thrive in their own right.
But haven't pigeons sort of dialed down their flight response? They're not afraid of people. They're not as flighty as other birds. And so, you know, that's why they're called a pigeon. A pigeon's an easy mark in our, you know, in our language. And that way, when humans aren't around, those predator raptors can pretty much have their pick.
Exactly. I mean, for any animal that moves through a city, they naturally have to turn down their predator response, because it is just too energetically exhausting for them to react to humans as they would a potential predator in a natural environment, just because there are so many of us around that, you know, if a pigeon were acting as terrified of us as it, you know, assuming that we were going to eat it or kill it, I mean, they would be exhausted after a single day. And so one of the early behavioral adaptations that happens with synanthropic animals is that they become kind of unmoved by humans. And that's a natural response that is often required for them to survive in cities, because they need to, just like any other animal, be as efficient as possible with the energy that they exert. But as you say, you know, and as we've said, you know, throughout this conversation, city ecosystems are not constant. They are not static. They are transforming. And what we've seen in a lot of different places in North America and elsewhere is the emergence of the urban raptor. So hawks, eagles, yeah. Other, you know, large hunting birds that have moved in because they've identified that actually these are places that have an abundance of prey. And so now you've got this kind of this behavioral arms race where you've got pigeons that have found a way to
And owls and everything else. I got to take a break here. We're going to take I've got a question, a comment, a favorite synanthrope in your neighborhood. Give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues after this break. Stay with us.
Support for TPR comes from UT San Antonio, offering degree programs and research focused on workforce development, student success, and health innovation across Texas. UTSA.edu. UT San Antonio, the University of Ambition.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the animals that we share our cities with the author Dan Werb. His book is Our Wild Familiars, How Animals Are Adapting to Cities and Reshaping the Natural World. Let's go to a caller, 833-877-8255, for you to join the conversation like Robert. And Robert, you're on The Source. Go ahead.
Look, you know, I got to say this. The conversation you're having, it doesn't make sense, because what you're really saying is the city officials, maybe throughout the country, haven't doing their job. These animals, we're making pests out of these animals, in a sense. They're really dangerous. They carry diseases. They carry rabies. They attack small children, et cetera, et cetera. They'll get into households and carry diseases there. Why don't you use this conversation to see why the hell don't city officials trap them, kill them, get rid of them?
Robert, interesting call. Thanks for calling in with that take. Dan, so this is not a United States thing or a Western civilization thing. This is something that happens in every cities around the world, right? And what would happen if we took that approach that the caller is recommending?
So look, I mean, I totally understand where the caller is coming from. It can be extremely frustrating to feel like we aren't mastering our own spaces. And I'll just say, as you said, this is not an issue that is unique to Texas or North America. This is a really, really a global issue. One of the chapters in the book covers the experiences of a town called Al Baha in Saudi Arabia. So I went to this town. It's in the mountains in western Saudi Arabia. And this is a small town, and it is completely overrun by baboons. This is a town where there are literally hordes of 600 baboons that have regularly been raiding garbage dumps and, you know, city park garbage bins and breaking into people's houses. And it is not for lack of trying.
So this is in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah. So this is not a, you know, a government that is known for, you know, its leniency when public order is being threatened.
Well, people don't normally associate baboons with Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, well, there are six baboon species. All of them are indigenous to Africa. There is only one of them that has left Africa and moved into Saudi Arabia through a land bridge at the southern tip of the Red Sea. And moved into Saudi Arabia, the mountainous regions of Saudi Arabia from there. It's actually, incidentally, the same land bridge that humans are believed to have used to exit Africa about 100,000 years ago. But, you know, I went there and they're everywhere, right? Like these are large creatures. They're quite dangerous. They're pretty scary.
And they don't, do they fear people, or do they come right up to people and steal their backpacks?
Well, it depends on the context. There are some pretty terrifying videos that I've seen and that other people could watch online if you're interested in that kind of thing, of baboons raiding, in one case, a girls' college. And so you see all these students that are hanging around on kind of a grassy courtyard, and suddenly there are these brown blurs that are moving down, scaling the walls that surround the courtyard, and then chaos ensues. You have these large baboons that are attacking the students, that are stealing their backpacks, that are biting, that are scratching, that are just trying to get access to as much food as they possibly can. And I'll also just add, you know, yes, this is an international issue. There are places all around the world that are struggling with trying to manage urban animal populations. But there is evidence from almost 30,000 years ago of human communities being, you know, having animals living among them, having these synanthropic relationships with animals that have moved into these human modified environments.
Right. So as I understand it, this college used to have a problem with feral dogs.
Oh, yes.
And so they had all these feral dogs that were running around, and then they removed the feral dogs, and then the baboons took over. So the dogs were actually keeping the baboons in check. So to the caller's point, if we think we're being so smart and we're going to remove one animal, something else would probably move in.
Exactly. And this is where thinking about cities and towns as ecosystems in their own right is really useful, because ecosystems are made up of different niches. There are different sort of places in that ecosystem that incentivize a species to, you know, remain there, to exploit a niche, to find a way to live. And if you just kill all of a particular animal, the niche is going to remain there, right? So, you know, if you have garbage that is available in a city or a town, and you just say it's overrun with rats, you kill all the rats, well, that garbage is still there. And it's either going to attract new rats or, you know, another animal that can outcompete rats for that ecological niche. And so if you really want to transform cities and towns in ways that make it less likely for some of these pests or animals that are considered pests to be active there, you need to think about, okay, what can we do to transform the urban design of our spaces, to reduce, you know, or remove particular niches? And that's actually what Saudi Arabia, after a 60-year-long battle to basically eradicate their way out of their baboon problem, is finally doing, which is focusing on ensuring that all waste is covered, is able to be, these bins aren't able to be opened by baboons, to make sure that people aren't feeding baboons, because that's something that happens. So, you know, often we're providing mixed messages to animal species in our communities, and really try to change the urban design itself to allow to reduce the incentives for animals to remain there. And also, you know, on the other hand, it's about opening up spaces within our cities to ensure that when animals find their way into our cities and towns, they can also find their way out, and so that they don't become trapped in urban environments, because that's often where this conflict arises from.
I should mention that San Antonio has had its own baboon problem. Southwest Research here in San Antonio has one of the largest baboon colonies in North America, which they use for scientific testing, and occasionally a couple will escape and will run around the neighborhoods. Let's go to Randall on the phones. And Randall, you're on The Source. Go ahead.
I've got a story for you. I went for several days. This was about 4 or 5 years ago. I went several days waking up in the middle of the night and hearing this scraping sound, like a gnawing sound above me in the attic in my bedroom. It sounded like rats. I dealt with rats earlier in my life, so I was familiar with that sound. I found a non-lethal exterminator online. They came out to the house, and they told me I had a couple of ringtails in my attic. Ringtail, R-I-N-G-T-A-I-L, one word. This was the first time in my 56, 57 years that I'd ever heard of ringtails. Everybody listening, just Google that, and I'll let your guest go into the details on this interesting animal. But the exterminator installed these weird-looking contraptions on my house. They were one-way doors. So when the ringtails left the attic for food and water, there was no way for them to get back in. And they just moved on. And about a week later, the exterminator returned, removed the one-way doors, sealed everything up nice and tight, and I've never had a problem since. But, yeah, y'all have talked about raccoons and coyotes and everything else, but talk about the ringtail for a moment. That's kind of interesting.
Oh, well, they're pretty cute, I think. So, Dan, ringtails?
Yeah, they're an amazing animal. They are a member of the Carnivora as well. They are very closely related to raccoons, and you can see that sort of in their body shape and their coloring. They sort of look like, you know, like a cutesy cartoon version of a raccoon, I would say. And they're in, you know, they're endemic to hotter, drier areas of North America. So it would make sense that, you know, particularly in Texas, that you would see a lot more of them. You know, and I'll say this, like the presence of ringtails and the presence of, you know, I'm sure a lot of your listeners have probably come across animals that are not, you know, the regular urban animals that we hear about or see, like not a rat, not a raccoon, not even a coyote, but these more, for lack of a better word, sort of exotic or rare animals. That is something that is particular to the U.S. Southern region, right? Like the Southern U.S. is one of the most biodiverse parts of the entire continent. That's related to the fact that, you know, a ton of North America during the last ice age was covered by glaciers. And as the glaciers advanced south, that pushed a lot of species, not only animals, but also particularly important are plant species, into the south. So into Texas and other areas in the south. And this has transformed the south into this, the last bastion of a lot of species that we don't see anywhere else. When we talk about the plant species, they're referred to as, in this region, they're referred to as ancient relicts, R-E-L-I-C-T, which are the last examples of plants that were endemic or, you know, found across the entirety of North America, but were pushed south after the last ice age as glaciers advanced. Now,
Let me take a break here. I'm going to hit this break. And sure. Alicia, we're going to get you on the air. And also Carl, we'll get you on with your questions. And you can call in, tell us about your favorite animal encounter, close encounter with the wild animals in our cities, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Our wild familiars, how animals are adapting to cities and reshaping the natural world. More on that when we come back. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Dan Werb is with us, the author of Our Wild Familiars, How Animals Are Adapting to Cities and Reshaping the Natural World. Let's go to a caller, Alicia. Alicia, you're on The Source. Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, you sound good.
Okay, hey. Hey, so my name is Alicia, and everybody knows me as a bird lady because I've watched birds in the city for over a decade. I know you're not familiar with our migratory birds here, but they are in the central flyway where they come through to breed. And the city has been chasing them out of multiple ecosystems, rivers, waterways, different parks throughout the city to get them out, right? They don't want to, it seems like they don't want to, how do you say, meet them in the middle, give them a space in a forest, you know, they could have nested in the forest. So what are your thoughts? I do real quick want to say thank you because I read what you wrote about, you know, that cities should change, manage those risks while preserving habitat, building wildlife crossings, and designing structures that shelter birds, bats, insects, whatever. So I have this sign I bought at the Dollar Tree, and it says perspective changes everything. What are your thoughts on trying to get our city, San Antonio, to change their perspective on these birds that come through this flyway, you know, to do what nature and, you know, they have to breed to keep their species alive. But the city is not wanting to, what do you say, to work with them, you know, give them a space, you know, manage them in a friendly, you know, manner. What are your thoughts or what are your suggestions? Because we've tried everything to try to get the city to see, you know, these birds are beautiful when they're nesting. You see people all over the world posting them, you know, they're breeding plumage, but there's just no happy medium here for our city. And it's really sad because the people that suffer are the residents and the businesses where these birds have move to. So what are your suggestions for Alicia, a city that is just hard-headed?
Thank you for calling in, and let's go to Dan Werb. And the city has complained about bird strikes. And so that's something that, you know, happens a lot, not just here. You know, it's a thing. So can you talk about all that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, one of the things that really motivated me to write this book is I think that if you're advocating, you need to be advocating from a place of kind of optimism and hopefulness and passion. And I think what we've seen historically and still to this day is that cities and towns are not considered places where nature exists. And so one of the things I'm trying to do with this book is really illuminate how complex and important urban ecosystems really are. So if you can connect with nature in your backyard, if you can feel connected, that is when you can start really engaging in this fight. It's extremely difficult to work with municipalities because they are so constrained in terms of budgets. There's no municipality out there that, you know, is flush with money and looking to spend it on everything. But, you know, I think one of the issues that's super important is that we're actually in this period of great transformation. We're in what biologists call the great urban shift. And the migratory birds that you're talking about are a part of that. So biologists are predicting that over the next few decades, there are going to be literally thousands of new animal species that are moving into cities and towns across North America. And so the onus is only going to increase on cities and towns and their governments to find ways to manage this. And again, it's not about whether you love animals. It's not about whether you hate them. We have to recognize that they are going to be among us and that we have to find ways to balance and sustain these ecosystems if we want to avoid issues like bird strikes, if we want to avoid, you know, businesses that are upset that they're overrun by birds or you know, the homeowners concerned about coyotes, you know, marauding through their gardens. So it's hard, but, you know, this is where the conversation starts. Ecologists have used this framework that's called ecosystem services to try to convince policymakers to engage on this issue, which basically is kind of a complex way of describing ecosystems in financial terms, right? It's, you know, ecosystem services refers to this idea that every ecosystem provides benefit to humans. And so if you can identify those human benefits, and you identified some in terms of tourism dollars or things like that.
Psychological benefits.
Know, yeah, well, exactly. Psychological benefits, spiritual benefits. There's something about interacting with animals and plants and nature that that has been scientifically studied and shown to reduce cortisol levels, reduce stress. So I think it takes sustained pressure. It takes a community of people that understand that they are participating in ecosystems, that cities and towns and urban environments are actually beautiful and worthy of conservation efforts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everything I think can flow through that.
Let's go to Carl. Carl, you're on The Source. Go ahead.
Thank you for having me on. Now, about 15 years or longer, I used to live in Live Oak, and my female cat, for some odd reason, attracted an ocelot.
An ocelot?
He would come over, you know, I'd let her out at nighttime because I'd work at night, and then when I'd come home in the morning, they'd be sitting out there on the porch. And the funny thing was that I had a neighbor complain, and when animal control came out and looked, they said, that's an ocelot. They asked me, did I own it? And I says, no. He just showed up. And they had to tell a neighbor there's nothing they could do because it's a protected wild animal.
Well, but, Carl,
that was really strange.
Did you get pictures? Because it's a beautiful over. It's a beautiful cat.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
And he would bring over gifts for her, you know, like a snake, and leave them there on my doorstep.
Wow.
All right, Carl, thank you for that. So Salvador Dali was famous for having a pet ocelot. So it's a wild animal, not domesticated, but apparently it will hang out with people. You're actually dead.
And they are, yeah, they are beautiful animals. And again, you know, Texas is one of the most biodiverse places in all of North America. And so I love hearing these stories of the animals that people are, you know, have these moments with. And I think it's, again, it's everybody has an animal story, and it makes you realize hearing these stories that there is something incredibly special about these moments of interacting with different species that can really change, you know, that really sticks with you, right?
I want to ask you about the audio space that we share with these animals. I mean, if we stop and listen, we can hear a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, there are particularly bat biologists that refer to cities and towns as urban acoustic spaces, right? And that's related to the fact that bats are one of the most successful urban species. There are over 80 different species of bats that live in cities and towns across the entire world on every single continent except for Antarctica. And when bats move into urban spaces, they actually often adapt their echolocation. So they'll reduce or lower the frequency of their echolocation down to lower in the ultrasonic range to allow their echolocation calls to travel the further distances that are, you know, present in urban spaces. So, you know, compared to forests or nature, cities are wide open, right? And so when a bat moves into an urban acoustic space, it has to drop its sound waves, the frequency of its echolocation, to allow those sound waves to travel further. So that's one way. But I think the other thing that you're, you know, maybe referring to here is just the fact that if you can listen in an urban space and you sort of attune yourself to it, there are all kinds of sounds. And I referred to earlier, you know, these studies that have shown that hearing birdsong actually reduces cortisol level. Well, it turns out that actually the more different types of birdsongs that you hear at the same time, like a cacophony of different bird calls at the same time, actually multiplies that stress-reducing impact of these calls. So, you know, there's just something about being around animals that just really moves us.
So it does seem like the natural predator for many of these animals is the car, because you will come out on the morning and see maybe some raccoons and other animals that didn't quite get out of the way of a car. I mean, why can't they adapt better to stay away from cars?
Well, cars are, from the perspective of an animal, you know, you think about highways particularly, like we're talking about a wall. We're talking about a wall of moving metal. The highways have also been referred to as an ecological trap, because what they do is, you know, they'll create a carcass when it hits an animal that will actually attract other animals. And so the fact that, you know, highways kill so many animals is attractive to other scavenger or predator species that then are at risk of collision as well. There's been some amazing work done though in Houston in particular with this Kinder Land Bridge.
Yeah, we have a land bridge here at Hardberger Park.
And
it's been very successful, and they've documented all sorts of animals crossing over all the time. And it was controversial at the time when it was proposed, and I think many people in San Antonio who've walked across it, they just think it's the greatest thing, and we need more of them because they're successful and beautiful, and they create a great urban space. I want to thank you, Dan Werb. His book is Our Wild Familiars, How Animals Are Adapting to Cities and Reshaping the Natural World. It's a great talking to you and thinking about this and changing our perspective. Appreciate that.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.